Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s. It works for members like...
I'm Haley, and I've lost 100 pounds. Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects. It's all in one place.
Weight Watchers handles the insurance for you and offers affordable cash pay options. With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
I'm Mike, and I've lost 135 pounds. Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
I'm Sharia, and I lost 80 pounds on Weight Watchers. I realized that it would take more than a prescription to lose weight and feel good on a GLP-1.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last.
I can't imagine doing a GLP-1 without Weight Watchers.
Get started for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com/GLP-1. For over 60 years, we've helped millions of members find what works for them. Now, it's your turn. Weight Watchers, watch it work.
This is episode 439 of Wheel Bearings. I am Sam Abual-Samad from Telemetry.
And I'm Nicole Wakelin from Test Miles and many other places.
And Robbie this weekend is taking a weekend off with his wife and dogs, hanging out at a cabin somewhere in Sonoma and enjoying what is at least definitely much warmer weather than either you or I are experiencing right now.
It is so cold. So we had like the, you know, the warning, don't go outside, dear God, people, you're all going to die. Cold warning, because there was a wind chill combined with the fact that when I left the house at 6:30, it was two degrees. And when I opened the garage doors and the wind hit me, I was like, oh my gosh, I'm dying. It was so cold this morning.
when I went to walk the dogs about 8:30, it was about 5, and it's up to about 17 now.
Let's see. I think we're supposed to get decently warm. See,
it
this
did get
is
up
all...
to 33 on yesterday.
So you know it's Friday. Winter when you're when, hey, it's 12 right here now.
Yeah.
I mean, downright balmy, right? Jeez. It's the thing in New England or in, you know, Michigan, when it's super, super cold and you've been dealing with single digits or low teens, and all of a sudden it's 30, you're like, wow. It's like, it's only 30. It's still cold. Put your jacket back on.
Yes. I wear when I walk the dogs, I wear multiple layers because, like, where we live on to the west of our house is a golf course, so it's, you know, pretty wide open, and we often get winds blowing across the golf course, so
yep.
It gets fairly windy. So I wear multiple layers when it's this cold, because otherwise, you know, the wind just slices through, and then once I get around the block on the other side of the block, and it's blocked by the houses, then it's not quite so bad.
Yeah, it's just freezing in general because it's two and it's windy.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter where you stand. When it's two and it's windy, you're freezing.
but my doggos with their thick double coats, they don't mind the
cold.
They
don't care.
They're fine with the cold. It's the only thing, when it gets below zero, then, you know, then they might get saying, okay, I've had enough of this nonsense. But the main thing that, you know, bothers them is just, you know, making sure they avoid the salt. When they get salt on their paws, it's been so cold that they, you know, they've plowed the roads in the neighborhood, but they've only a couple of times put down any salt in recent
Everything
weeks.
Looks white, like the pavement is white. And when you have a lot of cars on the highway right now,
salt.
It's this little cloud of salt, which is really gross. You think about how hard that is on your car, right? Because it's not just like salt shaker salt. It's this like special salt that they put on the highways. And I every time I see the cloud, I'm like, oh my God, it's just like, I feel like it's just little like monsters eating away at your car. I'm like, look at the cloud. It's like I'm driving into like a noxious fume that is like just going to degrade the metal as I go through.
Well, the other thing you got to remember too, you know, I mean, you know, there's less daylight now, so you're going to be relying on your headlights more because there's more chance you're going to be driving in the dark.
Mm-hmm.
And when there's salt on the road, that salt is also going to end up on your headlights.
Yeah.
And so, you know, before you go out, you know, if you live somewhere where it's cold like this, you know, just take, you know, have a rag in the garage or wherever, you know, or next to where you have your keys, you know, and just go out. When you go out, wipe off your headlights. You know, because you're going to have a crust
difference.
Of salt on your headlights. Wipe that off, you know, so you get some light, at least for a little while.
It's that weather where you don't realize how compromised your vision is between the salt in the air and the short daylight and the garbage that is on your headlights. You know, take an extra second so you can see where you're going. I have had now 2 weeks in a row, vehicles that have had problems. It's so cold. The windshield washer fluid is not squirting out of the washers. It was, now it's not. And I had that all week last week. I had it happen today. And I was like, crud, because there was some salt stuck, like dried on the way. I'm like, I can't see. And literally, I'm grabbing a handful of powdery snow from the snowbank before I drove away. And I threw it at my car windshield, and another handful of, threw it at my car windshield, and then I used my wipers. I'm like, well, that's got to hold all the way to Boston today.
I think last week, when I had the Mazda CX-70, which I'll talk about in a little bit. I hadn't put the, I have a cover, and this is another thing. If you park your car outside in this kind of weather, it's not a bad idea. You can get these covers that drape over your windshield. You can put your wipers up. Well, that's the thing. On a lot of newer cars, because, for aerodynamic reasons, the trailing edge of the hood kind of comes up over the wiper blades. And so you can't lift your wiper arms up in the air anymore like you used to. And you still can on a lot of cars, but you can't many newer cars. But even if you can't lift your wiper blades up, you can get these covers. They're pretty cheap, and it hooks onto your mirrors and your side doors, just to keep the snow and ice off the windshield. And then, when it's time to go, if it's snowed overnight, just take that off, give it a shake, throw it in the back of the car, and your windshield is nice and clear. And you're also less likely to get that salt or snow and ice build up on your wiper blades, rather on your washer nozzles. So that'll help as well.
I currently have on the side, the driver's side of my window, because there was so much muck yesterday when I was driving, and I was driving at night, and I was using the washer fluid like crazy because it was so. I got up this morning and it's blue. The bit of ice is now light blue. So it's matching. I'm like, well, I was using a lot of fluid. It literally looks like you put blue ice up there. It's like a little scene from Breaking Bad. What is that is stuck to the side of my windshield?
So what have you been driving?
I have been driving. It's kind of cool that I was driving this. I had the Palisade last week, and this week I have the Ioniq 9, which I think is kind of neat because I sort of went from the second-gen Palisade, right? Wasn't the second-gen on the Palisade?
Yeah.
And it's their gas vehicle to the first-gen of their three-row electric vehicle. I like the Ioniq 9. It's, the styling of it is sort of a love-it-or-hate-it thing. It's very bulbous from the back. And it's very flat in the front, has these massive lights. Right now, it's funny. You don't realize how much, just in general, this isn't a Hyundai thing. The safety systems and all of the things that it sees the road and does all that, nothing works right now because there's so much snow on the car and salt on the car, like you're talking about. This isn't specific to this vehicle. Anything runs into this. This is not a Hyundai,
Things
this
like
is a car
camera,
take.
Cameras will get covered up by ice and salt.
I went to back up and my backup camera just was brown. Like I couldn't see it. So I'm like throwing my arm over the rear seats, looking, backing up. My daughter's like, go, mom. I'm like, I did this for years before we had a camera.
Even the radar sensor on the front will, I've had it get crusted up. As you're driving, it might be clear when you leave, but as you're driving, the slush and stuff from the other vehicles builds up on there, and you'll get this crust of ice.
It doesn't take much. It's you get the dirt, you get the muck, it takes out those sensors, it covers them up. You could be at a gas station and clean them all off, and then 5 miles down the road, you get all the warnings again. And the good thing is, it does give you the warnings. So you get the warning saying, hey, some of your systems are disabled because the sensor's blocked. It was all the sensors. I think this Hyundai warns me for every single sensor. We were laughing this morning. It was like, this isn't working. That isn't working. And again, not a Hyundai. It's just technology in general does not like this kind of weather on cars. It really, really doesn't like it. But really nice to drive. Actually had it. It's been a crummy week. We've had probably in the last week, probably half a foot of snow altogether, a couple of decent little storms. The roads have never really cleared up, kind of like it was for the Palisade the week before. So it's slushy and messy. Now, what's interesting is I put it in. They have terrain button. There's drive modes that are just regular drive modes and terrain if you're like in mud or snow. And I put it into snow mode because snow. And noticeably better. Traction, everything gets better because it automatically flips back to the regular mode, whether you have eco, sport, and I think it's normal they have for settings. If you have whatever you have it set to in there, every time you turn the car off and on, it goes back to that. So I was getting in out of the car in the snow and then I'd start to pull out. I'm like, why? Why is this having trouble? Oh, wait a minute. Click that terrain, snow mode. Now we're good. So it actually truly did make a difference because I noticed it every time that it turned itself off when I got out of the car. So it was fine driving. You know, even in that, I always feel like the sketchiest thing is not when you're driving in the middle of a really big storm, because we all try and avoid that, right? When there's a foot and a half of snow actively falling. It's right after the storm. Or when you're trying to drive out of a driveway or from like a parking lot into traffic, and there's just a little bit of slush and snow still left on the road. And if you're not careful, you think you have plenty of time to pull in front of that car, and you don't, because your wheels spin a little bit, you lose traction a little bit, and suddenly you're doing that like, ah, because you're cutting it much closer than you intended to. This did a really good job of avoiding that. It really was good at pulling out. I could see people getting stuck. I could see people like having that moment of panic as it took them an extra 2 seconds to get out. I didn't have that happen. When I put it in snow mode, this thing was fabulous. So I really did enjoy driving it. And I am driving the all-wheel drive Performance Calligraphy. So this is pretty much the top trim. There's a calligraphy. I think there's one other special trim, calligraphy design or something above this.
Yeah.
But this is basically a top trim. It is, all told, $77,540. Do you want to take a guess on destination on this?
I'm going to say $1,495.
Okay. This says, gosh, and my thing is blurred. It looks like it says 1,200. Wait, got to do math. 4, 5, 6, 7. Yeah, 74, 75, 76, 77. It looks like maybe it's 1,800.
Oh.
Either way, it's more than what you thought. But okay. You win because Robbie's not here. So, but this has everything. The cheapest version of this that you can get is about 59,000. The most expensive is 76.5. So there's a pretty good spread. That cheapest one, though, the least expensive, is rear-wheel drive. Once you get out of that S, you're in all-wheel drive all the way up, and it takes a jump to 62.7. So not an inexpensive car, but this is a three-row. This is an EV. It has, you know, plenty of power. It's got 303 horsepower in some of the trims. It's got 422 in what I am driving right now. So it is more than capable of getting out of its own way. Plenty powerful. You know, that quiet EV thing, the instant acceleration you get from an EV. Charging times, they say like 10 to 80% is about 24 minutes, a 350 kilowatt charger. 10 to 80% in about 40 minutes if you're using a supercharger, because it has the NACS built in, the Tesla charging port is built in. I have an adapter, so I didn't charge it at a Tesla. I just use a little adapter, charge it at the house, super easy. It does say, and I keep wanting, you might be able to turn this off, but when you plug it in, it's like, it takes a second and it's like, vehicle is now charging. And every single time
I think there is a setting
to
turn that off. To
it's a little bit like voice of God. You're halfway in the yeah. house and you're like, okay, thanks.
Yeah, it's quite loud. Because we,
it
you
is
know,
very
we have the same
loud.
Thing on our EV6. They have it on all the Hyundai, Kia, Genesis vehicles. And I'm pretty sure there's a setting where you can turn that
I'm
off.
I'm sure you can turn it off. I just didn't play with it. But I guess it is good too, because then if you somehow haven't, maybe you didn't really plug it in and click all the way or something. You know what I mean? You would notice that it didn't say that and think, wait a minute, am I really charging my car? Three rows. It has 6 or 7 seats, depending on the setup that you have. Plenty roomy. We have these lovely little captain's chairs in ours. My daughter loved them. She said it was nice and roomy. Plenty of cargo room. It has a great big infotainment screen. There's like a 12.3-inch infotainment screen and a 12.3-inch digital instrument cluster, but they're in that one display. So it has that illusion of being one giant screen, which I think is such a nice clean look. I like it when they do that, just so you don't have like two separate blocks. It's like one nice thing across the dashboard. So I like it overall. I mean, it was really comfortable, has heated seats, mine like heated seats, heated steering wheel. They've got second row heating controls. You've got heat for them. Like it's got all of the things that you could possibly want. It also has that same, that ergo motion driver seat that kicks in when you've been driving for so much time. I love that. I've just said, like, now 2 weeks in a row I've had a vehicle with that. I'm like, dang, I thought this was silly, but now I'm finding I love this. Like, it's just so nice. You don't realize, I think, sometimes you've been sitting and your body gets tired of sitting. And then that happens, you're like, oh, that was a nice little, like, massage. Thank
just
you.
Kinda,
thank
yeah, kind of kind of get your spine moving around
yeah,
a little bit.
Yeah, kind of just like, yeah. That's nice. And I didn't have to, you know, go schedule an appointment for a massage. Car's just like, I feel like you need this and does that, which is kind of cool. So I liked it. We were talking about, because this is something interesting, it's freezing cold, right? It was literally 2 when I left the house this morning because I took people to the airport, and it was 5 when I got back. So I was watching the miles per kilowatt hour. Am I saying that right?
Yeah.
And it was about 1.7. And I was asking Sam, because he is an engineering man, it's freezing cold weather. It used almost half the battery going back and forth to Boston. But is that 1.7? Do you think that's good in the conditions that we're having right now?
Under the current conditions, yeah. I think, you know, for a big vehicle like the IONIQ 9, I think that's, and especially, you know, with the calligraphy, which has the bigger wheels and tires and everything, you know, so there's more rolling resistance. That's not an unreasonable number to expect. So I'm just pulling it up here. Let's see. So the official rating, EPA rating for the IONIQ 9 all-wheel drive performance, you know, which has the same tires that are on the calligraphy, it's 40 kilowatt hours per 100 miles. So that's about 2.5 miles per kilowatt hour. That's the official EPA rating. I think, you know, in real world driving, you can actually do a little better than that. You can get closer to 3. You know, which is fairly typical for a large 3-row vehicle like this. But yeah, I mean, it's cold. You're going to have the heater on. You've got more rolling resistance, you know, on the,
yeah.
on, you know, with the slush and everything on the road. You know, the air temperature actually, you know, the air is more dense. It does make a difference. You know, not a huge difference, but it makes, you know, has an impact. So all these things add up. And, you know, even if you're driving a gas car, you are going to notice that your fuel economy is significantly worse.
Well, I think that's really important. Say that again. Even with a gas car.
Yeah, any vehicle. Your fuel economy is going to be probably, you know, in these same conditions, your fuel economy is probably going to be about 25 to 30% worse than normal. And that's just, you know, that's physics. There's no way around that.
It's not exclusive to the EVs. I think when we notice it and why it gets talked about so much on EVs is I'm going to bet that most people might don't know exactly the miles, like how big their gas tank is and how many miles they necessarily get per tank of gas. You don't worry about it the same way. People get nervous in EVs. So you look and you suddenly say, well, you see it saying instead of having 200 miles of range, you have 150. You panic. You don't see it so vividly in a gas vehicle. And I don't think you notice it, but the same thing happens. Same thing happens.
Right. And you know, people are still, you know, so used to, you know, okay, your fuel gauge gets low, pop into a gas station, fill it up, you're on your way again.
Right.
You know, and if you're driving an EV, if you're charging at home, if you just plug it in every night, you're going to start the day with a full battery anyway. It's not going to be an issue. You are going to use more fuel. Or more energy, you know, regardless of whether it's a liquid fuel or electrons, you're going to use more. You know, as an example, we were talking just before the show started, or before we started recording, you know, we've got a Kia EV6, which is same basic architecture as the IONIQ 9. You know, same type of motors and same battery architecture, just not a little smaller. And when the weather was warm in the fall, you know, we were, you know, my wife, who mainly drives it, was getting about 3.7 miles per kilowatt hour with it. Right now, you know, she likes to have the car nice and warm and toasty when she gets in the car. She doesn't like to get into a cold car.
Me neither.
And, you know, in the past, you know, when we had our Civic, you know, it had a remote start, but, you know, she'd have to open the garage door, you know, reach out, hit the button to open the outside garage door, and then remote start the car to warm it up. And then it's sitting there burning gas for 10 minutes, you know, until it gets warmed up. With the EV6, now she doesn't even open the garage door because it's electric. You know, just hit the button, remote, you know, she has the temperature set where she wants it, you know, hit the remote start, And after a few minutes, it's nice and toasty warm. But, you know, it's, and, you know, when she goes to the gym or whatever every day, you know, she does that when it's cold like this. And so, you know, she's been averaging, you know, because sometimes the car might be sitting there for 10 minutes warming up. And when it calculates that energy consumption, it's doing it based on the total amount of energy it used since it's, you know, since you started, you know, regardless of the number of miles. And she's not driving a huge number of miles. So right now she's averaging about 2.1, 2.2 because she's using the heater to, and she it's only, you know, she only plugs it in once or twice a week anyway. Yeah. So a lot of the times when she's doing that, because she knows she's got plenty of battery available. And so she just starts, you know, remote starts it and it's using up the energy from the battery. And it doesn't matter. So,
yeah, it really doesn't. It's so, you know, it was still good. It's freezing cold. I still got back and forth to Boston, had just over half the battery left in this.
Yeah.
I plugged it in when I go out.
Roughly about an hour or so to
It's about an hour each way. 6:30 in the morning on a Sunday when it's freezing cold on Super Bowl Sunday and everyone's getting ready for their party. No one was on the road. So zip, 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 maybe like 45 minutes each way. Yeah. So, yeah. So, I mean, it was perfectly fine.
So an hour and a half of driving, you know, with the heat on, you used half the battery. You know, and, you know, if it was, you know, if it was warmer weather, you know, you would be using a lot less than that.
Exactly.
And, you know, even if you were taking a road trip, you know, in this kind of weather, you know, you got 3 hours of driving range. And for most people, 3 hours, you know, is about the time when you need to get out, stretch your legs, drain your bladder, and, you know, maybe grab a cup of coffee. You can stop at a charging station, plug in, you know, in this thing, the Ioniq 9, you can be charged up in 24 minutes or so. And, you know, that's enough time to, like I said, you know, hit the restroom, grab a cup of coffee, you know, stretch your legs, and then be back on the road again.
Exactly. So it was very easy to live with for the week, you know, and it was interesting to have, like, having just had the Palisade and having this, the differences between the two. Like, the similarities, they look different, but it still feels like a Hyundai, both of them. Mm-hmm. But it's basically what's changing is what's underneath between the gas and the EV. And they drive differently. It was sort of just a perfect comparison. It's like, not one isn't really better. It's just, do you want that EV driving experience or do you want that gas driving experience? So two very different experiences, and I don't know that one is better. It's just different. It's like, do you want an SUV or do you want a sports car? Well, it's not that one is better than the other. One suits your life better.
Well, a sports car is absolutely better. I mean, you're wrong there.
Okay, fine. But you know what I mean. So it was great driving this.
Unless, of course, you have to haul a bunch of people, then you know.
Then the sports car is not going to work. But, and this is also great too, because I had, my daughter was home. So there were three of us, and one of our friends was with us quite a bit. So there were three or four of us, and it was a nice, comfortable, easy car to put people in and driving around, and had their luggage on the way to the airport this morning. So, So I enjoyed driving it, even though it was an EV in freezing cold weather. Yes.
And best part is it started every time you got in it, right?
Every single time I got in, just push a little. Although that's weird. Okay, can I call that out? So the start button on this, poor Russ got in. He had to move it out of the way when he was snowblowing the driveway, and he comes in the house. Who designs a start button like this? This is stupid. It's on the stock. The gear shift and the start button are on the same thing. So when you look at the stock that the gear shift is, maybe 3 inches down from the edge, there's a rectangular or square button. And you push that button and that starts the car. And if
it's kind of hidden behind the steering wheel.
Exactly. If you don't know it's there, you sit down, especially depending on how you sat down, how you have everything adjusted. And you're like, where is it? That's what Russ did. He's like, who does that? And I'm like, Hyundai.
And Kia.
Yeah.
Kia started it with the EV9. They were the first ones.
That's right.
The EV9 was the first one to use that arrangement. And then Hyundai copied it on the Ioniq 9 and I think it's a little odd.
I mean, it's not like a problem, but it's an odd placement. And it is one of those things that you really have to kind of look. Like, even when I know where it is and I'm still tipping my head a little bit, like, where is it? I don't want to just play around and hit the car out of gear or whatever. So, yeah. So that was the one thing I really wasn't keen on that.
Yeah. Going back to the price for a moment. You mentioned the price was about 77-ish thousand for this one, which is you know, a fully loaded one.
Everything.
For comparison, a Volvo EX90, which I think, you know, is really a pretty comparable vehicle. You know, it's similar in size, similar in range. Actually, probably even a little bit. I think it's got less third row room than the Ioniq 9 does.
Okay.
You know, similar performance. It starts at $81,290.
Yeah. So there you go.
Yes, the Ioniq 9 is not inexpensive, especially in the calligraphy trim, but you can also get lower trims, you know, that are in the low 60s that are, you know, quite nicely equipped for that price point. And, you know, that's, you know, even fully loaded, you're still several thousand dollars less than the entry point for an EX90.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's, you know, when you're looking at the price, like there's an element of like, oh my gosh, it seems so much, but it's not in the grand scheme. And I think that's part of the thing to remember, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, there are more three-row electric SUVs coming to market. That's all I'm going to say about that for the moment.
There are more coming.
There's more competition coming to this segment.
Yes, there is more competition. It'll be interesting to see how things roll over the coming months and years. So,
all right. Did you know you can support Wheel Bearings directly? Head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia and you can become a patron today. Your contributions will help fund the platforms and tools we use to bring the podcast to you. And exclusives and improvements are already on the way thanks to your generosity. So if you want to be part of an automotive podcast like no other, head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia. We've updated the Wheel Bearings merch store, and now there's a whole bunch of new choices, new colors, new styles, t-shirts, sweatshirts, hoodies, hats, mugs, travel mugs, stickers, aprons, tote bags, you name it. You can get your Wheel Bearings merch at shop.wheelbearings.media. Go check it out. That's shop.wheelbearings.media. Well, I had a car that started off as a three-row gas or plug-in hybrid, or actually mild hybrid or plug-in hybrid SUV. And then Mazda decided to make a version of it that simply discarded the third row rebranded it from the CX-90 to the CX-70. Literally the only difference between a CX-70 and a CX-90 is there is no third row in the CX-70.
Mm-hmm.
They got rid of those parts. That's it.
Pull them out.
All the sheet metal, it's exactly the same. Everything else about these vehicles, the CX-70 and the CX-90, exactly the same. You know, same powertrains, same everything. From the driver's seat, you literally cannot tell which one of these you're driving in. But when you open the tailgate, you can definitely tell because there's a huge cargo area in the back of the CX-70. Now, granted, if you had bought a CX-90, you could get the exact same cargo space by simply folding down the third row.
Mm-hmm.
And then you still have that third row available in case you ever need it.
Exactly.
But if you absolutely know that you're never, ever, ever going to want to carry more than five people in the car, then you can get a CX-70. So I had the CX-70 Premium Plus, which has It has the standard powertrain, which is a 3.3-liter turbocharged inline six-cylinder engine, which is an absolutely lovely engine. I'm a huge fan of inline six-cylinder engines, always have been, because they're so smooth. I love the Hurricane six-cylinder and the Stellantis products. Love this thing. Love BMW inline sixes. This particular one is what they call the eSkyActiv-G. So SkyActiv G is their SkyActiv engine family with gas, as the fuel. eSkyActiv means that this one is a mild hybrid. So it's got a 48-volt mild hybrid system on it. So there's a belted starter generator, and a 48-volt battery. When you come to a stop or, you know, under certain conditions, even when you're driving, it, you know, could be coasting, it can turn the engine off. For the auto stop start, because it's a 48 volt system, it can keep the engine off longer, because a lot of times with 12 volt systems with auto stop start, once the battery level starts to gets down to a certain voltage, they have to restart the engine, even if your foot is still on the brake pedal. And that's when you feel it the most. The restart is when your foot is still on the accelerator pedal, because you kind of got a load on everything, and then you might feel a shudder. In this case, the 48 volt motor restarts it very quickly, with a lot of power, and it can keep the engine off typically throughout an entire traffic light cycle. So, from the time you stop until the light turns green again, it can keep the motor off, keep the engine off, because it's got enough power in that 48 volt battery to power all the other systems in the car without running out of juice. So the Premium Plus rides on 21 inch alloy wheels. The one that I had was finished in melting copper metallic.
Ooh.
Which, we had a few days of, it was very nice and sunny out, and against the snow, that this color looks fantastic. Personally, I think I would still go with Soul Crystal Red, but Mazda's got it when it comes to colors. Yes, they have some boring colors. They have some whites and blacks and stuff.
You have to have at least a couple boring colors.
But for the colors, when they do colors, they do them so well. And the melting copper just looks fantastic, especially in the sunlight.
Would you get melting copper or would you get the red?
Ooh. I think, maybe for something like the CX-70, I might go for the melting copper.
Yeah?
If I was getting a CX-30 or a CX-5, I'd probably go with Soul Crystal Red.
Okay.
Absolutely, for a Miata, absolutely Soul Crystal Red.
Required, yes.
Yeah. But, either way, they're both great colors. You won't be disappointed. You won't be bored looking at it. So this one, the Premium Plus, you get things like heads-up display. There's eight-way power driver's seat, lumbar support, memory for the driver's seat, heated front seats, leather steering wheel. This one does still, it's got two 12.3-inch displays. It still has the central control knob, which I know you hate, Nicole. I'm okay with it, but that's going away on new models, starting with the new CX-5. The new CX-5 just goes straight up touchscreen. It's got Alexa built in. This one's got Mazda's infotainment system that they've had for a little more than a decade now, which... you may or may not like it. If you use CarPlay or Android Auto, the screen actually does have touch capability. And so when you're using Android Auto or CarPlay, you can touch the screen and control it instead of using the central controller. Although in the very cold weather, the screen in the car I was driving was acting a little finicky. It didn't always respond correctly. Mm-hmm. It's got all the usual array of driver assist features that you expect: blind spot monitoring, lane departure warning, adaptive cruise control, all that sort of stuff. Vehicle exit warning, so that if the corner radar, if there's somebody in the back seat, corner radar detects a car coming up in the lane to your left, somebody might be getting out. You'll get an alert before opening the door. So if you don't open the door in somebody's path, the mild hybrid system was pretty transparent. Didn't really cause any issues. Never felt the start and stop was pretty seamless. You don't really notice it at all. The CX-70 with this engine has got 5,000 pound towing capacity. It's got drive modes with sport, off-road, and towing. This is not a car to be taking off-road. it's running on all-season tires. It's fine on a gravel road or something like that. This is not going to handle any trails of any notable difficulty. So there's an off-road mode, but you're probably not ever going to actually use it on this thing. I genuinely enjoyed driving this. I mean, as typical of Mazda, it's even for a larger crossover vehicle, SUV. It's got, you know, quite good driving dynamics. I mean, to the extent that I could explore them in these kinds of winter weather conditions. But I have driven it before in dry weather, and yeah, it's really nice to drive. Good balance of ride quality and handling, and responsiveness, plenty of performance. You know, the 280 horsepower for a 3.3 liter doesn't sound like a lot, especially when you compare it to the Hurricane. Mm-hmm. You know, Hurricane's 420 or 550 horsepower, depending on which variant you get from 3 liters. But you know, you are not going to be disappointed with the performance of a CX-70 or CX-90. And basically, everything I'm saying here applies equally to the CX-90 because, as I said, third row seat is literally the only difference.
Yeah.
The grand total on this one came to $51,945. Guess at the delivery charge?
I'm going to go $1,495.
You are very, very close. You're off by $35, $1,530.
Oh, wow. Okay,
which is kind of an odd number. I mean,
1530—that is a weird number.
Yeah, not sure where they came up with that one, but whatever.
whatever.
yeah, not a lot of options on this one. I said, you know, it's the premium plus, so this is kind of the highest trim level. So, you know, all weather floor mats, cargo organizer, and then for $150 and $100 each, and then $595 for the melting copper paint, and then everything else is included standard on the Premium Plus. It's rated at 24 city, 28 highway, 25 combined. Again, in this cold weather conditions, I averaged about 23, which is actually pretty good, better than I was expecting. So it's, you know, this is a, if you're looking, you know, and like, you know, all recent Mazdas, you know, it's got a very surprisingly premium feeling interior to it. The materials, the colors, you know, the fit and finish is really outstanding. And I think, you know, when you, you know, for $50,000 or, you know, $52,000 in this case, you know, including destination, when you look at some of the other products that are out there at that price point, you know, in a similar type of vehicle, this feels way more premium than most of the competitors. It you know, to get something comparable from a lot of other competitors, you are going to pay many thousands more. You know, like if you compare this to, say, a Toyota Highlander, you know, this feels way more upmarket than those than that vehicle. Or I think, you know, even I'm trying to remember how much was the Palisade Calligraphy. I mean, that was close to 60 grand, right?
I think that was close to 60. Let me see. I'll look. Yeah. Yeah, it's the thing is, Hyundai, it's interesting to compare the two because Hyundai puts a lot in a vehicle, but it doesn't have the, I don't think they get the premium feel as well done as Mazda. Like, it's sort of like every Mazda feels nice. Every Mazda looks a little bit upscale. Every Mazda has a pretty... If you step down really low in Hyundai's trim lineup, you start to feel that they're not as premium. Mazda does a fantastic job at making their cars just look like, ooh.
Yeah, I mean, even if you get the base models, like our daughter, she has a CX-30, you know, which I think she got not the base S trim, but like one level up. But even in the base, you know, CX-30, mm-hmm. It feels like a much, sitting inside it, it feels like a much more expensive car than it is. And it starts under $30,000.
Which is kind of amazing. And that's it's something that I'm driving the, what is it, CX-5? They're doing a first drive of this week.
Yeah.
And I can't wait to see it because it has the new screen. Woohoo. but also, I just, like, I love their cars. I always am excited when I get to drive them because they do such a nice job. Like, I genuinely like Mazdas. The thing that held me back was that infotainment setup that I really didn't like. That would have made me stabby during the day. But the fact that they're changing that, that makes Mazdas far more appealing to me. And I already like them a lot, so.
Yeah, I'll be talking to, interviewing Tom Donnelly, who's the head of Mazda North America on Tuesday afternoon. Mm-hmm. After I land elsewhere in California for a different program, I will be having a chat with him. We'll have that conversation with him on the show next week.
Cool. Excellent.
So that is the 2026 Mazda CX-70 3.3 Turbo Premium Plus.
Oof, that's a mouthful.
Yeah. All right, let's move on.
Okay.
So let's go back to Hyundai for a minute. I think it was the Brussels Motor Show this week, Hyundai unveiled a new model there that we are not going to see here in North America anytime in the foreseeable future, likely. Although you never know, because Hyundai has this partnership that they did with GM for some vehicles, which I think includes like vans.
Mm-hmm.
And Hyundai has this really interesting van called the Staria, which you've been to Korea. I'm sure you've seen lots of these things on the road
in
Korea.
Yeah, they're everywhere.
Yeah. It's a really uniquely designed van, which I think actually looks really cool. I think it's a cool looking van.
It's a cool looking van if you're a van person. If you don't like vans, you're like, whoa, what's this?
Yeah. It was in Stuttgart that they showed it, not in Brussels, in Stuttgart. So they unveiled the Staria Camper Concept in Stuttgart. And this is a new, they're doing an electric version of the Staria. So up until now, it's had just internal combustion powertrain, but they've launched an electric version of the Staria. And they created a camper version of it. It's right now it's a concept, but my guess is that Hyundai usually builds these sorts of things. It was at the Caravan Motor and Touristic Trade Fair in Stuttgart.
Ooh.
That's CMT. The Staria is a pretty good sized vehicle. It's a big, fairly, I would say like a mid-size, it's not as big as something like, say, a Transit van, but it's bigger than, the older compacts like the Transit Connect and, some of those types of vehicles. So it's more of a mid-size, but it's three row. I guess it's probably similar in size to an ID Buzz.
Yeah, I would think. It looks like it. And it has sort of ID Buzz vibes in a certain way, not the cute, fun retro thing, but just in styling, the shape of it. Looks
it's
ID
got the camper pop top like you would find on older VW bus campers. I'm trying to remember. It's got export power that can put out 2.6 kilowatt hours of electricity per day. I'm trying to remember the range. It's got the same EGMP architecture as the rest of the Hyundai Kia Genesis EVs. So it's an 800-volt architecture. It'll charge from 10 to 80% in 20 minutes. The standard version is 218 horsepower, which is adequate. I've driven... Mm-hmm. Like the EV9 with that same powertrain, but it's front wheel drive rather than rear wheel drive. But again, for a van, that's fine.
Yeah.
They've got an estimated WLTP range of 400 kilometers, which is about 280-ish, 290 miles. EPA is probably going to be, real world is probably going to be around 260 or so. That's probably adequate. It's better than what you get out of the ID Buzz. This is something that Volkswagen hasn't built yet with the ID Buzz. They haven't built a camper version of it. And, there's a lot of people who've been, waiting for VW to build a camper version of the ID Buzz. And Hyundai has done it with the Staria, with the electric Staria.
This looks fabulous. Like I'm clicking through the pictures of how the interior morphs to give you basically a huge area that's a nice flat bed inside. You've got a little kitchen inside. It has that pop top, so you have all that light. It's really a cool design. A little table thing that pops out, slides out in the back. There's a thing for a shower where you can have it have a shower. It's really cool. I like this. I think it's neat. If you didn't want, it's a great idea. I would love to see it end up here. I would love to see it just be made. Forget here. I'd love to just see them make it. But it's always, you know, you never know with the concept. Is this just an experiment to see people, what people think? And if people like it, will they come back and say, yeah, we're going to build it, guys? Will they like it and say, okay, you guys love this, but we can't build this. Like, you never quite know what they're going to do. I hope they build it. It looks cool.
I think they probably will.
You think they will?
And at the very least.
And have it here? And have it in the U.S.?
Well, it depends. It depends on what comes out of this partnership with GM.
Okay.
You know, because, you know, they've talked about having, you know, working on vans together. So I could definitely see GM possibly offering, you know, a version of the Staria, you know, branded as, you know, a Chevy. You know, whether they would do the camper here. I think, you know, what might happen is they might end up working with a third party upfitter. Which, you know, to be fair, is what Volkswagen always did. I mean, they worked with Karmann to build the bus, the microbus campers. So I think, you know, you could see Hyundai partnering with somebody to, you know, they would ship them the vans and then have them upfitted with all of the gear. You know, put the pop top on there and various other things on there. So I hope that they build something like this. It'd be cool to have an option for something like this, especially in North America.
Yeah, it would really be great. I think it would be cool. Fingers crossed, because I want to see this one happen.
Okay. We have previously talked about China and their ban on hidden door handles. And this past week, they made it official. They published some regulations. Where is that tab here? So the page that I've got linked is in Chinese, but you know, if you use Google Translate, it gives you a pretty good translation of it. And there's some that I haven't been able to find the full regulation, you know, anywhere yet. I was trying to get a hold of it somewhere, but there are some interesting details, you know, in terms of how they're doing this. But let's see, some of the things that they mention in the regulation. So the system has to be designed to ensure that in the event of an irreversible restraint service, restraint device deployment, so that would be like an airbag, or a power battery thermal event while the locking device is in a locked state, so the locking device being the door handle, the non-collision side door can be opened without the aid of tools via the outside door handle. So, you know, if you get hit on the passenger side, the driver's side doors have to be able to be opened, or vice versa, without using any special tools. And then, in addition, each door handle, except for the tailgate, has to be equipped with an interior door handle with a mechanical release function. So no electromechanical switches on the door handle. There has to be a, you know, some sort of mechanical release function there. And it has to be, you know, in proximity and readily visible to the vehicle occupants. So you're not searching around. And we've talked about this before, like on the Tesla or the Rivian R1s, there's a panel on the rear seats. On the front seats, they have the mechanical latch, like literally 2 inches from the button, which is just ridiculous. You know, why bother with the button? And then in the back, there's actually a panel that you have to pop off. So it's not even visible. There's a panel on the door that the rear seat passenger would have to pop off and then pull on a cable to get the door open if the door loses power. So that has to be readily visible, not hidden. And then one thing that's not clear from the information I have been able to find, they give some dimensions. You know, so there's some minimum dimensions for the door handle that the somebody from the outside of the vehicle has, you know, have to. So you can't make it too small. It has to be a certain minimum size that you grab to open the door without any tools. Oh, it's 60 millimeters by 20 millimeters by 25 millimeters. So about two and a half by about 3/4 by an inch. Dimensions. So, you know, reasonable size door handle so you can grab it with your hand. The one thing that is not clear, you know, they want to get rid of, you know, the electrically actuated door handles that that have to pop, that you need power for them to pop out.
Oh, the pop out thing. Yeah.
Right. But like, for example, on our EV6, you know, it's got the door handles are flush. If you get the top trim levels, like a GT or a GT line, and the same is true on the Ioniq 5, it's got the same door handles. GM's got this on the Cadillacs, you know. So it's a pivoting door handle. So normally it sits flush with the door panel around it, and it's pivoted at one end. And on the mid lower and mid trim levels of the Hyundais and Kias, it's not electrically actuated. It's a mechanical handle. Mm-hmm. On the top trim levels, when you walk up to it with the key in your pocket, the handles will automatically pop out. But you can also do it manually. You just push on the one side where the hinge is, and the other side pops out, and you grab the handle. It's a little finicky. It's more so than, you know, just a traditional door handle, but you can get it open fully mechanically. It's not clear from what I've been able to find if that type of handle would actually be allowed.
Oh, okay.
The Tesla Model 3 and Model Y also have the same type of door handle where you push it in on one side and the handle pops out. And again, not clear if that's allowed. And I was talking to, who was I talking to? I think Dana Hall from Bloomberg the other day about this. She was doing a story on this. And she asked, you know, it's like any chance of, you know, U.S. regulators following this lead and doing this. I said, in the current environment, the current political environment, almost zero chance of having similar regulations here. However, you know, they sell 27 million vehicles a year in China and 16 million in the U.S. the last year or so. China is by far the biggest market in the world. And anybody that wants to sell cars in China is going to have to design their door handles to meet those Chinese regulations. And the other thing is, this goes into effect January 1st, 2027 for any new vehicles. And so anything that's already in market, they've got like a couple of years leeway before they have to redesign. But anything new launching from January 1st next year has to comply with these regulations. So basically, because China's doing this, the rest of the world is going to have to follow suit. You know, the automakers are gonna follow suit because they're not going to design two completely different door handle systems for China and everybody else.
It makes no sense. So they're going to design to the biggest market out there, which would be China. So, yeah. So we're going to see whether we mandate it or not. We're going to see some of this.
We're going to get better door handles.
We're going to get better door handles. Yes.
I'll be curious to see what Rivian does with the R2 and the R3, how they change those.
I know. It seems like it's funny because it's 27 that it takes effect, which is a year away, but that's not really that far.
Less than 11 months.
Right? And that's not like you're like, oh, that's a long time. That's plenty of time. Not when you have that's actually a very short amount of time in
China.
Some ways.
I mean, you know, they have,
to be fair, you're right.
Short
China's
product
quicker.
Cycles in China.
Yeah, they have really short product cycles, but still that's a lot. It's a big change. It seems like door handles should be so easy, but they're not.
Well, I mean, it's part of the safety system. So there's a lot of work you have to do to validate it, you know, because door handles get used a lot.
Yeah.
You know, so it's got to the mechanism has to be able to survive a lot of usage cycles. And
yeah, exactly. So I think it's a good thing.
Yeah.
I find the pop-out door handles and electronic door handles to be finicky at times. I actually hate the pop-out. I hate the pop-out door handles in the winter. Hate them, all of them.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, you and I have both experienced ice storms, you know, where your car gets encased in, you know, eighth or a quarter inch or more of ice.
Yep.
And at least with traditional door handles, you can grab that and pull it and, you know, crack the ice open and get the door open. With some of these, you know, with the flush handles and that, you know, fortunately, you know, our car is parked in the garage when it's not in use. So it's, you know, unless an ice storm happens while we're out and about somewhere, it's not going to be as much of a problem. But it's, you know, even with a mechanical one, if it's flush, you can still have problems.
Yeah. I also don't like them, and this sounds like the silliest thing, the ones that are at an angle when they pop out, you know, that you're just grabbing Like they don't pop out.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm describing. I mean, that's what the Kias and Hyundais have. That's what our car has.
They drive me crazy because if they're wet, even in the summer, you go to grab them and your hand slips off, and it's sometimes just like you catch. It's just I don't.
Yeah, no, they're too finicky.
Yeah, they're a little bit finicky for something that you have to use all the time.
Yep. All right. So next up, Jaguar. We saw last year a concept version of the Type 00, Jaguar's new electric GT, four-door GT car. And now Autocar got invited to northern Sweden to drive a prototype of this thing. I don't know if you had a chance to look through, watch the video or look through this.
I did not have a chance to watch the video, but I did have a chance to look through, and I've seen a couple of different people talking about driving this. It was a small crew that they brought out there, it's interesting because the feedback is everyone was afraid it wouldn't feel like a Jaguar, but apparently it does.
Yeah, the way they describe it, you know, I think the subhead here was, rides like an XJ, drifts like an F-Type. Yeah, so the XJ was their old big sedan.
Right.
And one of the things about the XJ was, you know, it was always renowned for having fantastic ride quality and decent handling. And so this, you know, they say it rides like an XJ, and there's a video where you see them drifting around on the frozen lake in this thing. At least the launch edition is going to have three motors and 1,000 horsepower. And depending on the mode and the driving conditions, you know, it's going to have different power bias. So it's a 350 horsepower motor on the front and two motors on the rear axle combining to 950. So you get a total at any given time, a total of about 1,000 horsepower, which is
absurd, like in a good way,
that's
but
a lot.
Also absurd. It's a lot of horsepower. And, you know, Mercedes Jaguar has said that, like, with their new reinvented Jaguar, it was not going to be the sort of mass market luxury that it was before. You know, the things that it wasn't the easy sort of more attainable luxury, that they were going to go super, super, super high end exclusive. And when you look at numbers like that and you see the car, you're like, oh, yeah, this is going to fit that.
Yeah.
It's not going to be affordable at all. It'll be worth it because it'll be 1,000 horsepower, but it's not going to be something.
I mean, this launch edition will probably be in the neighborhood of $200,000.
Right. Exactly. It's going to be really pricey.
Yeah. They say that in rain, ice, or snow, it'll vary between 50% to 75% rear bias for the power. In comfort mode, it'll be 54% to 80%. And then in dynamic mode, it'll be 65% to 98% rear biased. So you're basically going to get almost 1,000 horsepower at the rear wheels with this thing in dynamic mode. But you know, it'll vary based on the conditions. So they wanted it to feel more like a rear wheel drive car, but still have the benefits of all wheel drive. For better traction, better launch. A little more controllability. It looks like it's going to be pretty impressive. Say 120 kilowatt hour battery, a range of about 400 miles on the EPA cycle, 430 miles on WLTP, I'm looking forward. Hopefully, get to drive this thing sometime in the next year or two.
It looks really amazing. I mean, it really does. I think everyone was very skeptical about what Jaguar was doing. The original ad campaign that came out when they were announcing the new Jaguar was somewhat less than well-received. So to see them coming through, like, okay, here's an example of what we're actually building. Here it is. Get inside. Take it out. Drive it. It's like, okay, well, wait. So I think we're going to all have to rethink a little bit now that we've kind of seen the actual product happening.
Yeah, you know, and when you look at, I mean, the car they were driving was still wrapped in camo, but you can see that it's basically the design we saw on the concept. You know, same proportions of the concept. There'll be some details that are different, but you know, overall it looks like that concept. And yeah,
I would agree.
Be
you can see a lot of the concept in it. Yeah.
Late summer. Yeah.
So coming all right. soon.
Yep. So, you know, other automakers have had challenges when it comes to EVs, particularly our friends at Stellantis. As you are well aware, Nicole.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
anyway, Stellantis this week made a couple of announcements. They are doing a reset of their business. You know, we already know, you know, they canceled some programs, delayed other programs, for North America, they put priority on putting a Hemi or a Hellcat in almost everything that they can. And then once they do that, then they'll start launching other stuff. One of the things in this announcement, you know, they talk about, you know, we've kind of known about for a while is, you know, under the prior leadership of Carlos Tavares, you know, the product planning and everything was much more centralized in Europe. You know, basically, you know, Tavares and his team decided what was going to be built. And now they are giving more autonomy back to the various regions where they operate. Mm-hmm. Hence, you know, what we're seeing right now here in North America under Tim Kuniskis, you know, where they, you know, they're using the knowledge that they have in the various regions where they operate, you know, of their customers, what their customers want and need, or at least what they seem to want, not necessarily what they need, to try and get products that are going to be more appealing to their customers. And as a result of this reset, they are taking charges of 22.2 billion euros, or about $26 billion. Ooh,
that is a lot. Yeah, it's. I think they're all struggling. Every company, like, you know, Ford took a big write off. It's
yeah,
not.
They, Ford
it's
was
not
19 and a half billion.
19 and a half billion, which also billions with a B. It's a lot of money, and I think they're all kind of struggling with that. And it comes down to a significant shift and, in some ways, a reality check about what they can and can't do with EVs and what consumers are interested and willing to buy right now, not in 5 years or 10 years or 15 years. Regulatory changes, got all sorts of changes, you know, with just the winds of the United States at the moment and how things change. So I feel bad. It's sad because you're like, man, that's tons of money. And companies that are struggling more with it, I think, like Stellantis, I would feel like they're struggling more overall and their quality perceptions. It's like, oh, goodness, guys. Okay.
Yeah, well, and this, yeah, I mean, they actually provided a breakdown of this 22 billion euros of some, you know, where some of this money, what some of these charges are for. So 14.7 billion was for realigning product plans with customer preferences and new emissions regulations in the U.S. So, you know, that's reducing EVs, you know, bringing back Hemis and Hellcats. That's, you know, that's a big chunk of that. And then 2.1 billion was related to resizing of the EV supply chain.
So again, EVs,
including total of approximately 700 million euros in cash payments expected to be paid over the next 4 years. So this, you know, this is about, you know, when automakers do deals with their suppliers, you know, they get pricing based on expected volumes. And if they don't meet those volumes, they will often end up going back and renegotiating those deals. So, you know, the more you sell, the better, you know, piece price you get from your suppliers. And, you know, this happened back in 2009 or 10 with Toyota, when they launched the previous generation Tundra. It did not sell as well as expected. You know, they had done their parts pricing with their suppliers based on expected volumes of 250,000 units a year. They were selling closer to about 100,000 at the time. And so they went back and repriced everything, you know, and it ended up costing Toyota quite a bit of money. So, you know, in this case, you know, with their EV suppliers, a couple of billion euros for that. And then one of the interesting items here, $4.1 billion due to a change in estimate for a change in estimate for contractual warranty provision resulting from the reassessment of the estimation process, taking into account recent increases in cost inflation and deterioration in quality as a result of operational choices, which did not deliver the expected quality performance, now being reversed by the new management team. So basically, you know, they had, you know, again, as part of the accounting process, they have to estimate, okay, how much are we going to be spending over the life of this product on warranty costs? And they're, you know, they realize their warranty costs are substantially more than what they estimated, and they're adding another 4 billion euros to that to account for that. And, you know, a lot of that is here in North America. Not all of it, probably there's some in Europe, but most of that is here in North America.
When you think about the how things went with, well, like they just stopped doing all the plug-in hybrids, mm-hmm. and the number of recalls and warranty things that had to be done on that, which, you know,
do you know how many times your Wrangler has been recalled?
I've lost track. and he loves it. Like, Russ would not change it for the world. He loves having that car. But we have, I mean, the battery has been fully replaced in it. The hybrid battery has been completely yanked out and put back in. Various components have been yanked out and replaced. I mean, thousands of dollars in warranty covers, all covered, like they're all warranty stuff, but it's sort of a never-ending thing. And you think you multiply that by the number of those vehicles that they sold, you know, there's a lot of warranty and recall costs that have been, that they have eaten on this. And that's just the ones I know from having my own vehicle. And, you know, of course, the poor Swagoneer had its whole share of issues as well. So it's just been, there's been a lot of costs there. And it's interesting, you know, I think about that warranty thing, and it's like there's so many people that behind building these cars, there's so many engineers, there's so much smarts, there's so much experience, and yet still they've had such a hard time. They've had such a hard time of late.
Yeah. Another part of this, you know, a separate announcement that came out at the same time is that you know, Stellantis has a couple of joint ventures in North America for battery production. One was with LG. They had a joint venture factory in Windsor, Ontario, to produce batteries for future Stellantis EVs. That one's called Nexstar Energy. And then they also have a separate joint venture with Samsung in Kokomo, Indiana. They, as GM and Honda and Ford, have recently done with their joint ventures. They are winding those down. They have sold their stake. Stellantis has sold their stake in Nexstar Energy to LG Energy Solution. I heard somewhere, I haven't seen confirmation of this, but I heard somewhere that basically they're handing it over to LG for like $100. And, you know, they invested several billion in building this factory. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Again, I haven't seen confirmation of that, but that's the number I saw published somewhere.
Wow.
But LG is going to convert at least some of the capacity at that plant in Windsor to producing, can you guess?
What?
Energy storage system batteries.
Oh, God.
For data centers.
Of course.
Yeah. That's what they did at the expansion they did in Holland, Michigan. Yeah. They converted that from EV batteries to energy storage. That's what Ford's doing in Kentucky. GM's doing that with some of their capacity down in Spring Hill, Tennessee.
So, by the way, I'm Googling your $100 thing because I'm like, that sounds absolutely insane. It's not. So the Detroit News.
That's where I saw it. Yeah.
Yeah. Actually has it in there. Stellantis on Friday sold his 49% stake in a Canadian battery plant for $100.
Yeah. And $100. I think Summer Ballantyne wrote that story, I think. And she's a good reporter. So
yes.
I don't think she would have published that if she hadn't gotten confirmation.
So, yeah. So and literally $100 there, 49%.
I'm surprised they didn't just do it $1, just, you know, nominal.
I'll sell that.
Well, I guess $100 Canadian is about $1 US.
So, yeah, for $100. Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just like fire sale. Let's get rid of it. I guess you're sitting on a get rid of it. Take the loss, get rid of it, and move on.
Yeah.
You know, which—
Write it off and—
Write it off, be done with it. Yeah.
That's going to be another source of energy storage batteries for the coming years. And, you know, when I spoke to LG last year when I visited their plant in Holland, Michigan— they said, yeah, we expect huge demand for energy storage batteries going forward, mm-hmm. both for data centers, but also for grid stabilization, you know, support,
yeah.
renewables, things like that. So, all right. So how do you feel about hatchbacks?
I like hatchbacks. I think they're versatile little things. I am pro hatchback. What about you, Sam?
I am a huge fan of hatchbacks. Hatchbacks mm-hmm. and wagons, you know, especially on smaller cars. When you look at modern compact sedans, you know, like Civic, Elantra, Corolla, all these, you know, not maybe less so the Corolla, but a lot, you know, most of these have shifted over the last 10, 15 years to designs that have a fastback profile.
Yes.
And so what you end up with is, you know, usually, you know, a reasonably sized trunk volume, but a very small opening to get stuff yes. into that trunk.
So you can't fit big things in because the opening is teeny tiny.
Yes. Jalopnik, you know, they did one of their things where they put up a question for readers and posted some of the responses of, you know, which cars would be better if they had a hatchback or liftback, according to their readers. First on the list was the Miata. I don't know. The Miata definitely needs a hatchback.
I mean, the Miata is so cute the way it is. Don't mess with it. Yeah. I don't know that I feel that. I feel like the Miata is that one I disagree with because I just think the cute little fun little tiny impractical but stupidly fun car to drive, just leave it alone. Yeah. It's fine just like it is.
But most normal sedans, absolutely. You know, Camry, mm-hmm. Accord, Civic.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you look at the current generation Civic, you know, you get the sedan and the hatchback. And the hatchback is actually a couple inches shorter, but, you know, they look very, very similar in profile. Mm-hmm. And, you know, with the hatchback, you get 24.5 cubic foot of storage space behind the rear seats. Whereas in the sedan, it's about half that. It's about 13
yeah.
cubic feet.
I feel like any sedan you could change in and make it a liftback or hatchback and it would be greatly improved.
And then the Lucid Air. Now, this is one I don't entirely agree with.
Why not?
Because you know, the trunk lid on the Air, it's this sort of clamshell design that wraps around the sides.
It's a little different. This isn't just a standard trunk that just opens from the top. It kind of opens from the side.
So the whole trunk lid wraps around the side of the car. So it's like some crossovers, like the Audi Q5 has always been like that. And there's some others. And so when you open it, you know, you've basically got full access to the trunk volume.
It has a huge, like the opening is exceptionally large for a trunk.
Yeah.
So it's very easy. It's very easy to store larger items than you might think in the back of that car.
Although if you did make it a hatch, you know, and had the rear glass tied to that trunk lid and have it open at the top, you know, and then you have a folding seat, you know, you would actually have a really huge volume in there. So
it would be gigantic. Yeah.
Yeah. Ford Mustang. Yeah, absolutely. Mustang, you know, for the type of car it is, the Mustang has a pretty reasonably sized trunk volume, but again, very small opening.
Yeah, very tiny.
Yeah, the Honda Civic Si. The Si is the one trim level of the Civic that you can't get as a hatchback. The Type R is hatchback only. All the other variants are hatch or sedan, but the Si is sedan only. And then the Tesla Model 3, Again, you know, same kind of things as what I said about the air. You know, it's actually got a reasonably sized opening there. You can, the picture that they include in the story has the trunk open. And it's actually a decently sized opening.
It is a pretty decent size. I mean, it would be better if it was a lift back, but it's not prohibitively small. That's the thing with trunks. They can be, even if they're a big amount of space, it's all about how large the opening, that trunk opening is. And suddenly you're trying to wedge things in because that space, the opening is just too small. And you just try to shove a lot of luggage in and it's hard.
And the Cadillac CT4, you know, same thing, same story there.
Yeah.
And then the Audi RS3. And they actually have a photo of an RS3 hatchback.
Yeah.
Which is only sold in Europe. It's not available. In North America, they only sell it as a sedan.
That'd be awesome.
They have a hatchback. They just don't.
They've done it. Yeah, so that's not adding one. It's just like, bring it here, please.
Yeah. And the Genesis G80, Subaru WRX. Same story with all those. Like, they'd all be better with hatches.
I think most cars, if you could find a way to do a hatchback, there's some out there that are really good the way they are, but I wouldn't complain about making more cars into a hatchback to make that trunk more versatile.
Yep. All right, next up. So this is one that I was hoping to talk to Robbie about, but he's not here.
Do you want to hold it for Robbie?
Yeah, we can. It's about 3D printed pistons for Formula One engines.
Let's hold it for Robbie then when he's here.
Yeah, okay. We'll hold that one for Robbie.
Next week. Forget Sam mentioned it, everybody.
Jim Farley, for some reason, still posts on that site owned by that guy that is a Nazi. he posted something earlier this week with some teaser images of the new upcoming $30,000 electric pickup truck. And you don't really get an idea of what the thing is going to look like yet. But there's some interesting shots in here of, you know, some of the work that's being done, including using large unicastings for the first time, which I've talked about before. But this is the first time that we actually see one, you know, coming out of the quench bath after it comes out of the mold. So you see this huge aluminum die cast part.
That is huge.
Big part of the structure of this vehicle. And then you also see somebody else working on buffing the front end of one of the prototypes of this truck. So looks like this thing's going to have a very smooth front end. And then a couple of images showing the work they're doing in the wind tunnel and the aero efficiency of this truck.
Yeah.
One that is labeled as the best part is no part, but the second best part is one that serves multiple functions. And it's hard to tell exactly what this part is, but you see a couple of guys, big smiles on their faces looking at it. So
it must be exciting if you're an engineer.
yeah, absolutely. Although in the background, you can see, a little bit of, what is presumably the front casting, you know, part of this truck and front.
So
front.
I'm going to go with front.
The front wheel well and casting.
Yes.
And if this is the truck, it looks like that's the windshield there between their heads.
It does kind of.
It's really sloped back quite a bit. So it's going to be a very interesting truck to see.
It does look like a windshield. You're right.
Been promised we'll be seeing more of this in the not too distant future, in the next few months.
They've also, Ford, while we're still on Ford, has made some additional promises. 5 new cars under 40K by 2030. That's 4 years, just anybody who's counting. Four years, including a midsize electric truck.
Which is supposed to start at 30.
Yes. And it says the 5 new models will be across our lineup of cars, trucks, SUVs, vans, and it will be multi-energy, which means no one powertrain.
Yeah, so gas and hybrids and plug-in hybrids, presumably. Well, we know there's going to be at least range extenders coming to the F-150, but that's probably not going to be under 40 grand.
No, but I wouldn't think.
One thing that was that's interesting in this story here. Through these measures and those upcoming inexpensive products, Ford communicated to dealers. And this week they had the National Automobile Dealers Association conference Las Vegas, and all the automakers have meetings with their dealers during that event, during the NADA. Ford communicated to dealers that it intends to retain 70% of Edge and Escape customers and keep them from shopping elsewhere. So the Edge already went out of production more than a year ago. The Escape ended production in December, although they built up a bunch of inventory that'll keep them going for a few more months. But, you know, I have a hard time seeing how they're going to retain 70% of those customers.
It just feels like, I mean, I guess depending on what they introduce, but the cars are gone. You know what I mean? Like, so if you're one of those customers and you're looking for a new car anytime soon, you're not going with a Ford. You know what I mean? Like, you'd have to, I don't know. We'll see what happens. I mean, they could retain a good number of it. I'm sure a lot of Ford loyalists will wait and see what's on the horizon. But it does potentially, the delay in those are gone. The supply is gone in a couple of months of what's left. And then what? You know, if they don't have them roll.
Some of those Escape customers will buy Bronco Sports. But the problem is that they don't have enough capacity because they build the Bronco Sport and the Maverick both in their Hermosillo, Mexico plant. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're building as many as they can now. Yeah, you know, one of the things that limits their ability to sell Mavericks and Bronco Sports is, you know, they only have that one plant building them. Unless they're going to add production of one or both of those vehicles somewhere else, it's going to be tough to retain Escape customers with Bronco Sports or Mavericks. You know, some Edge customers might step up to an Explorer. But I think actually what we're probably going to see that, you know, we haven't heard yet from this is, you know, when I visited Ford's Marshall, Michigan battery plant last June, they told us that, you know, they're working on as many as 8 different vehicles from this universal EV platform. So the $30,000 pickup is just the first one, but there's a bunch of other body styles going to be built on that same architecture. So perhaps what we will see, you know, beyond 2027, you know, so the truck is supposed to launch, you know, go on sale early next year. Maybe that's going to be followed up by a new compact crossover built on that same architecture. So that would, you know, if they do that and can sell it, you know, in that, you know, low to mid $30,000 price range, you know, that could keep some of those Escape customers. Yeah. But I think a lot more than 30% of those Edge and Escape customers are probably going to go buy a RAV4 or CRV or Tucson or, you know, one of the other competitors.
I think you're right. I think a lot of people could go to other because there are very competitive options out there. So I think there's a good chance. I mean, it's a nice goal. It doesn't say they're definitely going to hit it. It just says we think we can keep 70. We'll see how that rolls out for them. Good luck.
And then Apple saying that they're looking at allowing customers to use third-party chatbots, AI chatbots, with Apple CarPlay.
I think that's kind of cool, actually. And it's
do
not
use,
confirmed.
Do you use chatbots?
I don't, but I think it's kind of a neat idea. I think it's I've never thought about using them in my car, but I think that's neat.
I mean, do you use Siri with CarPlay?
I just use Siri all the time.
Yeah.
It's not like I shouldn't say that. I don't mess with other ones. I'm all about Siri. So,
if they gave you the option of using ChatGPT Siri, next generation Siri is going to be based on Google's Gemini. So you'll have that. But, you know, if you could use ChatGPT or Claude or something else, would you consider trying those out at least?
I mean, I would definitely try them out. I think especially if you're using those, like if you're using ChatGPT for other things, depending how much it can connect with the other knowledge it has about what you've been doing, you know, that sort of seamless from your desk to your phone, to your car situation, that'd be cool.
Okay.
What about you? No?
I'm more skeptical of these chatbots. You know, I still, when I play around with them sometimes, and they often come up with nonsense responses that
correct
sound very plausible but are not actually accurate.
But sometimes
or
Siri
helpful
does too. Sometimes Siri gets a little confused.
Yeah.
Like I feel like it's, I don't know that they're better or worse. I don't know. I don't think I've used them enough to say that. But I mean, occasionally Siri's, you ask Siri a really reasonable question and you get back like, I'm sorry, I was asking for a bakery and you told me what the temperature of the sun is. How did I get that? You know, sometimes it gets really confused. So.
Yeah. So do all the others. So
yeah. Yeah.
None of them are that great.
I think you just got to pick your poison on that front.
Yep. All right. And then the last item is one that that you put in here.
Yeah.
You want to talk about that?
I wanted to add this. So NACTOY, North American Car Truck Utility of the Year, one of their things was that they we wanted to have a scholarship as part of our sort of mission. And we don't make money. And so when we have money, we decided we should have a scholarship. So we worked with the SAE, the Society of Automotive Engineers, Robbie's Turf, to come up with a scholarship for automotive journalism, design, and engineering innovation. The scholarship application period is for the month of February. So it closes on the 28th. And you can go to SAE. We'll put the link in the show notes and they can show you what the requirements are. But it's going to be to help undergraduates and graduate students who are pursuing these careers actually have a little bit of extra money to pursue something in automotive. And it's specifically automotive focus. There's going to be two scholarships each year, one for automotive journalism and one for automotive design and engineering. So we'll also support the job that Sam and I do, which is the automotive journalism, and the job that Sam did, which was automotive engineering. So I think that's cool. And so it's open to like spread the word. If you know a student, if you're in education and you know somebody, go check it out, share the news, get it out there. Because we want to give away some money to a worthy student. How's that?
Sounds good.
Yeah.
It's always good to help out people that are in, you know, trying to get educated, you know,
exactly,
to do the career that that they want to do.
Yeah. Any help you can get. So, you know, if you're looking for a scholarship, you know, some kids who are pursuing this, check it out. You can find it at SAE. If you go there, they have a section with all the various scholarships that SAE offers, and NACTOY is on there. Or you can check out the notes Sam will have up there. He'll put a link in there so that everybody can click and find the link. And please apply and share it. And good luck. I hope we get to give some scholarships to some worthy people.
Excellent. And one last item. Any progress on your car shopping hunt? Are you currently on pause? You know,
I'm in a holding pattern as I'm trying to decide. I'm going back and forth. So I haven't yet. And who wants to test drive a new car in New England right now, right?
Yeah.
But it's in a holding pattern. I have some thoughts. I'm going back and forth on some things, ruled some things out, still question marks about other things. So no news yet, Sam. No news yet.
All right.
Yet.
Well, keep us posted.
I will.
All right, everybody. We will talk to you next time. Bye.
Bye.